All right, it looks like this thing is on. It is indeed on. Welcome, everyone. I hope you had a good lunch and that that food doesn't put you to sleep. I have been told that my voice is almost hypnotic, and as a matter of fact, I worked as a hypnotist at one time in my life, so hopefully I won't put you under a spell. The talk today is an architectural talk, and so we won't be getting into bits and bytes. We won't be analyzing any protocol streams. And you know, even though those of you who know me as Dr. Isa would do stuff like troubleshoot IPsec connections, we won't be doing stuff like that today. Instead, we're going to take a look at some high-level issues and important considerations when you think about identity in a cloudy world. So we'll entitle this talk, The Four Pillars of Identity, a solution, maybe a discussion of issues for online success or success in the cloud. For those who don't know me, I'm Tom Schinder. I'm a principal writer and knowledge engineer in the Windows Server and Cloud Division Information Experience Group. Part of the work that I do is getting that stuff up on TechNet that you know. Before I joined Microsoft, I was heavily invested in ISA Server and TMG and ran isaserver.org. My wife now runs that site, and she is the ISA Server go-to gal now. While this is listed as a 300-level session, I guess that doesn't work. 300-level session. If you're expecting the traditional 300-level content where we're going to start analyzing packet traces, you will be disappointed. Okay? I'll try not to be boring, and I'll try to be thought-provoking or at least say something that you haven't heard before, but we won't be looking at code or anything of that nature. So our objectives today is that first, I'm going to talk about some key industry trends and how you might apply them to your identity management designs. Then the meat of the talk is going to be about the four pillars of identity and how you can use the concepts and the architectural issues around these four pillars to create a coherent identity solution, either for your cloud or even for your non-cloud networks. I don't want to stick to just cloud because identity is important in traditional data center environments, but becomes even more complicated when we talk about cloud because we have to deal with identities that are not necessarily under our control, but we have to deal with them. And finally, we'll discuss an approach that you can use to create an identity framework that you can use as you're planning identity and access control management systems in your own organization. I like this to be interactive, so if I say something that you want further clarification or have a question about or you disagree with or want to amplify what I say, please do so. This is not, if you were at my principal's talk, I was very professorial there and kind of took control of the whole thing. Because this is something that's under flux and we're still thinking about these issues around identity because they're fast-moving targets right now, any input that you have will be greatly appreciated. So we'll talk about the trends and challenges, and then we'll talk about the importance of identity as part of the introduction. So first, we'll talk about industry trends. We know there's explosive data growth. Data is growing at orders of magnitude. I remember there was a recent Gartner talk where they said that they expected a 44 times increase in the amount of data that IT organizations were going to have to deal with within the next 5 years, and that people are dealing with data in terms of acquiring terabytes of new data in log files and in SQL databases every day or every month. The thing is, from an identity and access management issue, this data just doesn't sit there. Someone's going to need to be able to access this information, and we have to realize that it's not an omnibus situation, that we're going to have to think about what the identity and access mechanisms are to access this explosive amount of data that is distributed in nature to boot. There are proliferation of devices. So it used to be that in a corporate environment, we told the users what devices they can use, okay? and we manage those devices, and we manage the user accounts of the users that logged into those devices. But our concept of identity in the old world was regarding the end user. Now, because we're having to deal with this BYOD, bring your own device situation, it means that we no longer manage many of these devices, but the devices themselves now represent an identity that we're going to have to deal with, identify, and manage in some way so that we can make access control decisions based on not only user identity, but device identity. Budget restrictions, well, this is an industry trend. You know, you hear people say, you know, do more with less. Well, that's easy for you to say, but it's hard to do. So when we think about how we're going to do more in terms of identity and access management, we need to think about a well-architected approach so that we don't waste cycles on things that are inefficient or ineffective that cause us to end up doing something dumb and costing more money to fix. Now, of course, we're all genetically going to, you know, designed to do something dumb from time to time, but if we can minimize or mitigate that issue, so much the better. And then, of course, IT constraints. You know, if we look at this pie chart, if we look at this pie chart here, you know, we spend about two-thirds of our time just keeping the lights on, 20% trying to grow our business and grow our understanding and the ability of service that we can provide, and only 14% of the time to transform our industry. Well, traditionally, this 86% represents the perception that IT represents a cost center to the organization. Our real value to the organization is going to come from this, and as we move into a cloud world and we move outside of keeping the lights on and start thinking of cloud capabilities where automation, including automation of identity and access management, will allow us to increase this time to transform our business processes so that our orgs can make more money, the companies we work for make more money. So now, what are our key access challenges as they relate to identity and access management? Well, like I mentioned before, we have to enable devices to get access, not just users now. So the iPad, the Android tablets, the upcoming Windows 7 slates, they all want to get to our information that we manage. And then the phones, and then devices we haven't even considered yet need access. How are we going to enable these devices access while maintaining control over what it is that they can access? And so we need to think about that when we put together our identity and access control schema. Availability, of course, is a thing. Remember, if you were at the principal's talk, we talked about principles of cloud computing, and one of the key principles was, or essential characteristic was, anywhere access, right? Access, ubiquitous access, broad network access, where users expect access to information from anywhere, at any time, from any device. If we can't provide that, if our identity and access management solution does not enable this availability, then we failed in our mission. Role and device-driven privileges. So we're used to the fact that if a user is a member of a group, then they had access to certain information and certain applications, and you know, that's a good way of dealing with things. But as I mentioned before, devices now have identities. And we have to be able to recognize the identity of a device, and based on the combination of the user and the device, we make decisions about what data users can access and what portions of applications that users can access. So it's no longer just, well, you know, Bob is a member of this group or that group. We also have to now think, well, Bob is a member of these groups, or as I'll talk about later, we move past group in terms of identity. We also have to think about Bob is using this trusted device or untrusted device from this location in the world or that location in the world, and make access control decisions based on these variables as well. And of course, we need to be able to allow partners and customers to access the data that we have on our networks, whether they be traditional data centers or private clouds. How do we do that? We don't manage these customer identities. We have to have some mechanism for the customer and the partners to use identities that we don't manage and fit those identities into our access control mechanisms. So the bottom line here, as we see on the bottom, is companies must facilitate productivity without impacting security. Now, I'll give you my opinion, is that we can address identity as an isolated issue and not even think about security. And in a lot of cases, I see that people come up with identity definitions and identity control mechanisms that have nothing to do with security. As a matter of fact, I mean, there are many different ways we can think about identity, and we are so primitive in IT in terms of how we think about identity, because we're not really dealing, if we're talking about a user, we're not really talking about the person's identity. We're talking about some credentials that have some loose coupling with the actual identity of the person that possesses those credentials. I mean, you certainly don't identify yourself with your username and password. I mean, Freud had, psychiatry has a rich history of defining identity. Freud talked about the id, the superego. Id, superego, and what was the bad one? Id, ego, and superego. Yes, and Eric Erickson talked about a social identity. Then, of course, in the religious context, people had this idea of identity in the soul. And then if you talk to a physician or a medical researcher, they'll say, well, your identity is your DNA. Talk to a neurologist, they say, oh, I can tell a person's identity through a magnetoencephalogram and the patterns there. Ophthalmologists will say, I can tell your identity by the retinal patterns and the veins and the arteries. Okay? All of these things are much more representative of the true identity of the user than this username and password, or if we really want to get sophisticated, maybe a RSA token. You know, we have to think about the level of assurance and the level of fidelity that we are using to define identity and then make intelligent decisions about how much we can trust. Now, we have technological limitations right now that we have to live with, but when we think about the level of trust we give to our identity identification and management solutions, we have to think about that in a global context. Okay, now we'll get off of my soapbox and move on. We also have management challenges. Okay, we have to adapt to the cloud. Now, adapting to the cloud sounds a lot easier than it is, because most of us can't even agree what cloud is. I mean, I have my understanding of the cloud, and I presented that understanding in the cloud principles, concepts, and patterns talk, but not everybody agrees with that. I wouldn't even say the majority of people agree with that. You know, we probably could get a dozen different definitions of cloud if I talked to people within this group. And some people think cloud is just a marketing term. But whatever the cloud is and whatever it ends up being in the next few years, the fact is identity and access management is going to be a big part of it. So we have to be aware of issues with cloud, where we might have to deal with federated identities, identities that are managed by, God forbid, Facebook and Google and Windows Live, where we have no assurance of the identities and their validity. But we're going to have to take these issues into account, and these trends are actually happening now. We also have to deal with the rapid onboarding of services. Gone are the days where somebody gets on the phone and says, you know, I need to get access to this application, this application, this application. And, you know, you say, well, I'll get to that in a couple weeks, but let me know if you have problems. You know, all the user wants to do is look like Sue and have the same privilege as his workmate. We have to be able to do this in real time, and this feeds back into the principle that I talked about, the principle of minimizing human intervention. So we're going to have to find a way to automate these services while having a high degree of assurance and fidelity, and these are not easy things to do, but they're things that we need to think about addressing when we build an identity framework. Mergers and acquisitions are something that we have to deal with frequently. So, you know, we have our identity structure all set up nicely, and then suddenly, bam, we acquired somebody. How do we mix those systems together efficiently? Now, this is not that different than having to adapt to the cloud, where we're using identities that were established and managed by people that we don't necessarily trust, and we don't necessarily even understand how they onboarded users and how they deprovisioned users. And then, of course, we have the issue, the age-old issue of proliferation. Great term, proliferation. We'll use that again later, of users and groups. You know, every time you stand up a new application, what happens? Well, you got to create, you know, 1,275 groups for that, and then you need to nest another 1,000 groups on top of that, and then another 20 groups on top of that, and then, you know, the service accounts need another 30 groups, and we'll just, you know, put those all together, and it's no wonder we have Kerberos token bloat. You know, we've got to fix that when we re-architect our identity and access control mechanisms so that we don't end up with the same problems we had in the past. We never want to repeat the problems we had in the past. I always say, I don't make the same mistake twice. I always think of new ones. And so, while we might not necessarily want to make new mistakes, we should not repeat the mistakes we've made in the past. Security challenges, like I said, security and identity are not necessarily completely aligned, but they should be aligned so that the identity people need to work together with the security people to make sure that their identity framework, their identity access and control mechanisms are actually secure, not just doing access control and defining identities. So we have to respond rapidly. Like I said earlier, people don't have time to wait. We have to protect our infrastructure while extending it to people that may be employees, maybe customers, or maybe partners. And we have to think about how do we do that in a secure fashion. We have to centralize and standardize. Now, this is one of the classic and most difficult things to do. I mean, sure, can you imagine a central Active Directory database where everybody goes into it? All the employees, all the customers, and all the partners. Well, I can imagine it, but I can also imagine that's never going to happen. So how do we manage all these identities and centralize them so that we can have a standard system so that we could do password synchronization across multiple systems, set a standard password policy across multiple systems? It's challenging because not all systems understand the security mechanisms that one system may have for identity management compared to another. One system allows you to create complex passwords and another one doesn't. We have to take that into account and see if we can deal with any kind of transforms to make those systems compatible. And of course, report and audit. Everybody loves to log information. Logging, if I see an opportunity to turn on logging, I'll turn it on because, you know, information is power. Knowledge is power. But does anybody actually look at that information? That becomes more problematic now as IT is maturing and the government and industry regulatory bodies are getting involved where, okay, if you have that information, I need that information made available to me. I need that information about if Bob, I want to know what Bob was doing at 8:30 p.m. or 8:30 a.m. Can we do that? Have you ever been asked to provide that kind of information? What was Bob doing between 8:30 a.m. and 9 a.m.? So you've been asked to do that. Was that an easy thing for you to do, to get a holistic picture of all the systems that Bob accessed? Okay, so he says he had to look at hundreds of different kinds of logs. And they were all disconnected, and did all the applications have the instrumentation you needed to actually tell what components of the system were involved? Okay. So essentially all he could do was tell them, you know, sort of what systems the person accessed, but couldn't really give detailed information. That's a difficult problem for us to solve, but it's one we do need to solve because these are the questions the auditors and perhaps law enforcement are going to ask us increasingly as we move to more complex systems when we deal with, say, private cloud and public cloud hybrid environments. So it's not just logging, but it's auditing where we have to have mechanisms in place where we can provide meaning to those logs and context to those logs across multiple systems. And then also we have to surface that information in reports. So our identity and access management solutions have to be able to effectively report this information, because you're not going to show log entries to an auditor or a law enforcement person. So we need to integrate a security strategy with our identity strategy. Now, finally, the importance of identity. Not all people think identity is important. I can honestly tell you that I completely avoided the topic of identity for most of my IT career. If I were ever on a project, I would turn the identity stuff over to somebody I didn't like. And if I couldn't find that person, I'd let my wife do it instead of me. So, fortunately, I must say that I've been given some responsibility for putting together an identity, architectural identity framework for private and hybrid cloud that I need to complete within the next year. And I actually find that identity is a very fascinating topic, and it's extremely important. Because without identity, are we really able to fully take advantage of all this cool software that's out there that can tell me what songs I like and tell me who my friends should be on Facebook and give me access to the applications that make me more effective at work? If it weren't for identity, I wouldn't have any of that and much more. So the light kind of turned on, bam, identity actually empowers me as a user to take advantage of all this cool stuff that software provides. So it's clear that identity is important in terms of empowering users. Identity, of course, is important when it comes to the issue of taking control. Now, wait a minute. I'm empowering users and I'm taking control? Well, sure, because if I know who these users are, at least I have some indication of who this user is, I can give that user the level of control and the level of access that user needs and no more. This feeds into the security principle of least privilege. And of course, identity is important for us to plan for the future. The cloud is the future. How are we going to extend our current identity framework into the requirements and the demands of a federated network, for example, where we have to allow people from to access our cloud services and on-premise services. So that incorporating identity into our environment, and not just simple identity, but compound identities potentially, can transform our business and be more agile and more effective. And that's the last time I'm going to say agile, too. That sounds too marketing there. So now let's define identity. We'll first talk about the role of identity and then go dig into the core of this presentation, which are the four pillars of identity. So the role of identity. So where is identity in our infrastructure? You know, we typically think about identity as a user. A user has an identity or a representation of his or her identity, which is a set of credentials that are provided to the system. But now we realize, as I've said, that devices also have identities too. And as you'll see with the new Windows Server 2012 capabilities, we have the ability to assign specific identity to devices and give them access privileges based on device identity as well as the user identity. But it's not just the user and the client-side device that have identities. Our infrastructure has identities. So the servers have identities. The routers and switches also have their own identities. Okay. The storage enclosures and the storage backplane has an identity, as well as the compute infrastructure. So these are identities, and these identities need to be managed as well. And of course, the applications and services have identities, right? These applications, like we think about SharePoint, for example. SharePoint doesn't, we don't have to go into the SQL database and configure specific identity and access controls to access information in a SharePoint library. We just configure them in SharePoint, and then SharePoint takes care of the rest. Okay? So it's the identity of the application that actually gives users access to the information on the back-end database. So if we look at identity, it spans the entire environment, but also when we start thinking about the cloud, we think about identities stretching from private cloud. Now, I almost did something bad. I was going to say your private cloud on premises, and I want to make clear that private cloud is not limited to on-premises deployments, because private cloud, by definition, is only one thing. It's a cloud infrastructure that belongs to a single organization. I want to make that clear. Private cloud is a cloud infrastructure that belongs to a single organization, whether it's hosted on-premises, whether it is hosted by a provider somewhere off-premises, it's still private cloud. Okay? So if our private cloud, we have to deal with identity stretching from our traditional data center, where we have users and devices, infrastructure, and applications and services, and extend it into our private cloud. A public cloud, in contrast to the private cloud, means only one thing. It means one thing. It means that it is a cloud infrastructure that's dedicated to multiple organizations. It means nothing else. Okay. A cloud is a cloud is a cloud. So it could be public cloud, private cloud, hybrid cloud, community cloud, or Mars cloud, or a ham sandwich cloud. Clouds have to have the five central characteristics to be a cloud. It's only the deployment model that sets it apart, whether it's a single or multi-organizational. That's the difference between private and public. So I've heard people say, well, infrastructure as a service is private cloud, and that's not true. You can instantiate infrastructure as a service in a private cloud or a public cloud. In a private cloud, you can instantiate infrastructure as a service, platform as a service when the Azure appliance becomes available, or even software as a service. I mean, one could argue that private cloud software as a service is just your Exchange and your SharePoint deployments. If you host those in your private cloud infrastructure, you're providing software as a service, plus you benefit from other capabilities such as elasticity and self-service, perception of continuous availability, perception of infinite capacity, and the other core principles of cloud computing. Okay? Very good. So, absolutely. So, the comment was we're not actually managing the users because there are laws against that. We're managing the user accounts that represent the users to the system. And the fact is that there are multiple accounts in various authentication repositories that represent that single user. So that's one of our challenges, too, and that goes back to the unified management of identity. How do we manage what is essentially a compound identity in multiple authentication repositories to reach the holy grail of, what's the holy grail for identity management? It starts with an S. Single sign-on. I heard someone say single sign-on. That's right, and we'll talk about single sign-on in a little bit. So we have to think about identity as being essential not only to the traditional data center, but also as we migrate to private and then hybrid cloud. So how do we view identity at this time? This is where we start our introduction to the four pillars. The four pillars are administration, authentication, authorization, and auditing. Those are our four pillars. I've heard people say there are only three pillars, which would be the administration, authentication, and authorization, because identity has nothing to do with auditing. Our argument is that you can't have a true identity solution without auditing, because we have to provide those reports and intelligence information to not only individuals in our business, but to regulatory agencies and to law enforcement. If we don't have a strong, reliable, and trustworthy identity management infrastructure, we're not going to be able to provide that information that can put not only us personally at risk, but our entire company and our fellow employees, so that we consider auditing, which includes logging and reporting, too, as critical as part of any identity and access control management scheme. So the administration pillar really is about a single view of managing identities. Even though we may have multiple authentication repositories, we really need to be able to manage that identity as an atomic instance. Easy to say, very hard to do. We also need to be able to apply various business rules to that single identity so that when a system accepts those credentials, it can apply business rules regarding is the user going to have access, either granular or coarse access, and we'll talk about that in a sec, what the difference is, and then be able to apply those rules based on the identity. And then we should be able to have automation. Remember, private cloud is about the principle of, well, it's not all about the principle of continuous availability, but you can't have continuous availability without automation. Also, we have the principle of minimizing human involvement in cloud computing, which means that we have to support automated requests, approvals, and access assignment, which means we have to be very good at defining policies based on the identity credentials provided to the system. Now, in the authentication front, we have to think about, yes, user sign-on experience. Are we going to provide single sign-on? We're going to provide simplified sign-on, probably more realistic than single sign-on. When we think about single sign-on, actually, I'll inject here opinion from a security guy, since I spent most of my life as a security guy. As a security guy, I consider single sign-on Armageddon. And why do I consider single sign-on Armageddon? Because it becomes ridiculously easy for an intruder to penetrate dozens or potentially hundreds of systems based on single sign-on. Are you aware of what happened with LinkedIn in the last few weeks where the password database was compromised? Okay. How many of you use the same password in LinkedIn as you used in multiple other accounts? I'll raise my hand first here. All right. That put me at risk at Amazon, put me at risk at Barnes & Noble, put me at risk for Facebook, put me at risk for multiple other sites, too. Many of them had my credit card and other PII associated with it. So from that perspective, the kind of pseudo-single sign-on that I had by using the same credentials at each site put me at enormous risk. So it's something we want to think about in terms of single sign-on and how we mitigate the risk of single sign-on. This is why I say that we can have a very robust identity management infrastructure and meet the holy grail of something like single sign-on and have an enormous security hole in our system. Something to think about. We also want to make sure that the identities come from a trusted source. We want to be able to verify those identities. We want to make sure that they're valid, that there is some level of assurance with those identities, that at least provide us some assurance that the credentials actually represent the person that's presenting them. And then we want to use standard and secure protocols, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. From the authorization standpoint, we want to think about how and where the authorizations are handled, and then we'll do our little rant about LDAP. When we talk about where authorizations are handled and talk about sort of how authorization and authentication work together. And then can a user access the resource they can access when, or can they access the resource and what can they do when they access it? And what I mean by that is going back to the discussion where, say, anybody know the product UAG? UAG Unified Access Gateway? It was an access control device that allows, it's a SSL VPN, a reverse web proxy. And it has some exceptional capabilities where if you publish, say, Outlook Web Access or SharePoint, depending on who the user was and what device they were using, you could surface various controls within Outlook Web Access or SharePoint so that if they were from an untrusted device and maybe they were located somewhere in Borneo somewhere, for example, you might not trust the device so much as if they were on campus using a managed device. And so different controls would be made available through transforms that the UAG would do. So, well, you don't have to use UAG. Other solutions could do the same thing. And trying to stay away from products here, but just giving an example of capabilities we're talking about when we want to control the level of access based on user. Finally, auditing. Can we track who does what, when, where, and how? Very difficult. I heard one person say that Yeah, we can do all that. We can do all that. If given enough time and enough resources, we can do all that in the rearview mirror. So give me a month, and I'll troll the logs, and maybe I'll be able to piece together a story from all these divergent systems to give you, if not reality, at least an arguable representation of reality. Well, we can't do that because, you know, the pace of our industry is moving quickly. Organizations, legal, governmental, and industry consortiums are all expecting us to respond like that. So we're going to have to re-architect our identity management frameworks to include auditing that can provide that for us so that we can have things such as focused alerting and in-depth collated reporting. So we get the intelligence, that's fine, but we have to have reporting that provides meaning to someone who is not like one of us, an IT pro that can scour the logs and provide an internal meaning. We have to have a system that can do that for us, for those who are not like us. And then, of course, strong governance, risk management, and compliance issues. So now let's dig into the administration. First, let's get a common understanding of what administration provides before we go into each of these. So administration provides a system that's highly configurable around business processes. Okay? We want to be able to take that single view of identity, even if it's a compound identity that's managed through multiple systems, and apply business rules to that identity. Okay? Administration provides that. The agility to scale resources on demand. Okay, this means that we're not just talking about user identity, we're talking about a cloud attribute where the service itself has an identity and there are policies applied to that service that tie into the cloud fabric controller that allow the service to gain more resources from the shared pool on demand and conversely return those resources back in the pool when no longer required. This means that the service itself and the infrastructure that it runs on also needs identity management. Cost savings through the distribution and automation of management. Well, this speaks again to the concept, the private cloud concept of automation. One of our key lessons is you cannot fully benefit from cloud if you don't have a fully automated system. I mean, no system can be fully automated. I understand that. There is no software that is going to stack, rack, and stack servers. There's no software yet, unless we start getting into robotics, I suppose, that is going to cable servers. There is no software system that's going to provision the hardware for our storage infrastructure. But anything that does not require human involvement, which is typically a physical activity, and albeit one that takes a lot of knowledge and insight to carry out, is still a physical activity that a machine can't do. And finally, the administration provides flexibility and synchronization around synchronization, proliferation, and change control. Again, we need to make sure that these compound identities that we work with, because there's no single view of identity anymore. We create a synthetic single view of identity because none of us have a single Active Directory forest with a single user in that forest and can access all resources. Unless somebody, is somebody running an all Microsoft shop here? Any? Okay. Well, my mom runs a bakery, and she has a all Microsoft shop, but she's going to get the Microsoft Cloud Edition because she saw the commercial. Cloud Edition? Oh, maybe they didn't play that here in the EU. Okay, well, not all jokes go over well. So when we think about administration, key issues that we need to think about, provisioning and deprovisioning. Okay, we want a self-service of provisioning. That's great. But what happens when the user leaves? If this user has identity in multiple systems, how are all these systems notified that this person's identity is no longer valid within our network, within our organization? Do you have mechanisms in place that do that for the dozen, two dozen, 30 or 40 systems that they need to manage? Probably not, right? Some people might find out that somebody was released because they went to the cocktail party on Friday night and found out that Bob was fired from the company. Said, oh, crap, what did Bob have? Let's see, he was in Exchange, and he was in the CRM system. Oh, and SAP was there, too. You know, that's not the way we do it. That's not efficient, and it's not effective, and puts us at risk at multiple levels. How do we update identity? I mean, simple updates like the person has changed job roles. Person has changed his or her name. Person has changed her position. How do we update dynamically that person's identity to reflect the access permissions that are going to be enabled as a person changes over time within the system? Okay? We can do that in Active Directory using users and groups, but moving forward, we're going to have to think about more sophisticated mechanisms that use things such as claims, so that instead of using this very coarse-grained approach, we can understand a person is more than just a group member. The person is a member of a team or a project or a part of the country or part of the world or a part of the building. I mean, some people have access controls based on just what building they're in or what part of the building they're in. There are some super secret areas. Then we need to think about synchronization. We have to synchronize passwords across multiple systems. How are we going to do that? Maybe we could use something like FIM to do that. Or some similar solution. There I did. No more product mentions here. This is architecture. Group management as well. We need to think about how to effectively manage our groups. We don't want to nest 10 groups into 100 groups to another 100 groups because there's not just Kerberos token bloat. We can have claims bloat too, obviously. So we have to be more insightful about how we do group management and maybe even move away from group management and think of more sophisticated mechanisms using things that, like SAML or XACML. Okay. Identity proliferation I've talked about a lot already, where a person has identity in multiple systems within the organization, or if it's not an employee but a customer or a partner, they will have multiple identities in their systems. A partner, remember, has her own problems, and you have to be able to maybe perhaps consume their identity. And then we have the issue with interface selection. How are people going to update their own identities? Are you going to send them to 20 different portals for each system, or can you give them a single pane of glass where they can manage their own identities through a self-service mechanism? And finally, we have an issue of change control. Okay? That goes back to provisioning and deprovisioning, goes back to also group management and identity updates. But also change control has implicit in it change tracking. Okay? Sure, we can control change. We can enable people to make changes to their own system, or we can change aspects of their identity or their credentials for them. But we have to be able to change this because we may need to do this for forensics or just for routine reporting to give to our auditors. So administration is about managing that single credential or a group of credentials as a single entity. So administration is identity management. Now, what about authentication? So authentication, to sum it up, would be authentication provides, as we see here, a flexible, standards-compliant authentication that integrates across the organization. Well, that certainly sounds good. Unfortunately, all the systems don't understand the same authentication mechanism, so that's something that we need to factor into our identity management system. The integration of disparate sources, applications, and protocols are also required in any kind of authentication solution, and that it needs to employ many different industry standard methods of validation and assurance. And validation and assurance are extremely important, because if you don't have validation and assurance, then you might as well not have an identity management system. And essentially, if you don't have a validation and assurance, then you might as well just have anonymous authentication and just have someone, sign in however they want, because otherwise your system doesn't reveal any meaningful information when we start doing auditing and reporting. So we have to first, when we think about authentication, flexible sign-on methods. Now, flexible sign-on, the most flexible would be single sign-on. Everybody wants single sign-on, so they sign in once, and they can access any system behind that they want to get to. Now, going back to the UAG example, we had capabilities to do something like that where someone could sign in once, and UAG would be able to be configured to query multiple authentication repositories and find your account based on the credentials that you provided to UAG. And there are similar capabilities in other systems too. But you want to make it possible for users to either sign on in a single way, which is the holy grail, but you know, has anyone ever tried to implement a single sign-on solution in here? Okay, so quite a number of people. How many of you got it to work the way you really wanted it to? Okay, it's very difficult, right? A smart guy once said to me, single sign-on is not really a solution. Single sign-on is the emergent property of a well-architected system. Well, So you can't buy a well-architected system. You have to have architects that really dig deep into what the requirements are and what the capabilities are that can feed those requirements, and then start searching for software solutions that can meet those requirements, that surface those capabilities. The challenge is that while we are aspirational regarding single sign-on, the reason why we have to be aspirational is because software hasn't caught up with our aspirations yet. That doesn't mean that we stop searching for that solution. It means that we have to continue defining our requirements in that area and work within the limitations of current systems, always realizing that there will be a point in time where software will catch up and provide us with what we really require and what we expect. Supported sources. So when we're doing authentication, who's providing the authentication for us, right? Is it a source that we trust? Like, this is where we start talking about LDAP. I mean, what is LDAP? Lightweight Directory Access Protocol. So what happens? The user sends a username and a password to a system. The system then goes ask authentication repository, do you recognize this username and password? I don't know if I'd really call that authentication. My idea of authentication is that you obtain a token from a trusted source, and then you present that token to a system so that you don't leave it up to the destination system to go ask for you. There are too many security implications for doing that. And also, if you've ever implemented LDAP, LDAP itself as a protocol doesn't have any security embedded in it. So have you ever seen anybody deploy LDAP with that SSL wrapped around it, TLS wrapped around it? Sure. I mean, I've made that mistake plenty of times myself. You know, so it's not, it's an old protocol, and we use it as a last-ditch effort, but many things have happened since then. You know, instead, what we want to use is something like, well, then, you know, the industry grew and we had NTLM, right? So we had this shared secret and we sent the secret, and that was, and we didn't send, you know, clear credentials over the wire, and that was better. But, you know, it wasn't great. But then MIT thought of this thing called Kerberos, where, you know, Kerberos, we could get a ticket from the system, and we present that ticket, and it was sort of like a carnival, right? You go to a carnival, you buy your tickets from the ticket granting box office there, and then we take the tickets, and the box office can confirm that we paid money, that we had we were a supported source, got our tickets from a supported source because we paid the money. Then we presented that ticket on behalf of the ticket issuer so we can get on the ride. So Kerberos is a carnival. So that's even better. Supported sources for authentication protocol. And then assurance methods. Okay, how are we assured that the person's credentials are actually representative of the person that is providing these credentials? Now, like I said, there's all different conceptions and frameworks for identity, going from medicine to psychiatry to psychology to religion and so forth. But we don't have that luxury because there's a lot of overhead by taking those other considerations in mind. Maybe in the future we'll be able to encode all that other information into a little chip that, you know, will bury into your cerebellum or something like that, and then we can use near-field communications or RFID to do that. But hopefully that'll happen after I'm long gone. Okay. I don't want to be that assured of anyone to be that sure of my identity. However, there are things that we still can do. I mean, username and password, yeah, that's good enough, but it's really not. You know, so we need to move forward to things like two-factor authentication so that we can provide some sort of thing that we know and maybe some sort of thing that we have. If we want to be really good, we want to use multi-factor authentication so we can combine something that the user knows, something that the user possesses, and then something that is the user, such as a fingerprint or retinal scan or voice print or analyzing facial images or some combination thereof. So as we add more and more factors, we have greater assurance levels that the person is who he or she is, but at a cost of usability. Somebody very smart in the identity space said that what's good for IT is bad for the user and is bad for the system as a whole. So we have to find a balance in terms of, you know, how much assurance we need. So let's talk about authorization here. So what does authorization provide us? Well, first, it provides us extensive methods for assigning entitlement, allowing for increased security and less administration. So when I think about entitlement in our current age, I think about groups, because it's groups that are provided entitlements to access different resources in our network and through the services that we provide. They also provide us policies that are written or centrally enforced. Now, This is the grail here, central enforcement of policies based on authorization policies. And have any of you seen the claims-based access control mechanisms in Windows Server 2012? So we recognize that these centralized policies are important, right? And also on SharePoint, too. That's right. So authorization allows us to enforce these policies. We also want to simplify and accelerate enforcement through either an agent or an API or proxy-based approach for authorization. So we don't necessarily need to obtain authorization directly to a system, but we can do it through some layers of abstraction. And I think when you think about cloud, I want to think that, you know, cloud is a lot of things, but the one thing that enables cloud to be cloud, which is different than the traditional data center, it's not the perception of infinite capacity. It's not the perception of continuous availability. It's not minimizing human interaction. It's not taking a service provider's approach. It's not providing metered services. It is abstraction. Just like the hardware abstraction layer in Windows NT, anybody remember when you first read about that? The how? Right? The how? It's like, you guys, you old-timers out there, remember all the driver issues and all the things where there was this extremely tight coupling between the hardware and the software interfaces? The how enabled that abstraction so that, to use a modern example, I won't go into the ISA bus and setting the DIP switches and the IRQ levels. I understand USB, bam. 1,000 different devices now can be provided. That freed us in so many ways before the introduction of the hardware abstraction layer. Now with CLAD, we're talking about the software abstraction layer. And that will enable us to do many, many, many more things than we ever imagined, just like what happened when we had the hardware abstraction. Not sure how that deals with identity, but it's something that I got excited about. So at authorization, we're talking about entitlement type, okay? So the user authenticates, and then we have to decide how we entitle that user to access what information and what aspects of an application. Then we have to think about the access policies. So think about different layers of the system access policies, okay? We have fine-grained and coarse-grained access policies. If we think about four layers, we think about the data layer, the application layer, the network layer, and the operating system layer. So at the data layer, we use fine-grained policies. We want to be very specific about what data a user can access and how they can access. Can they read? Can they write? Can they execute? And various other permissions we assign, right? At the application layer, we kind of want to do the same thing. The application should be able to control what the user can do with the data that's accessed through the application. So the application acts as a proxy for the user. So So the user, using the SharePoint example again, the user isn't authenticating with the SQL database on the back end of the SharePoint, right? We're assigning permissions through the SharePoint application, and the application is proxying that information back and impersonating the user on the back end, right? Then, so those are examples of coarse grain access policies. Now, if we think about the operating system, that's an example of coarse grain. At the operating system level, the user is able to access the operating system or not get access to the operating system. So we got a binary, very coarse, yes or no. Same with the network level. We think about network level access, we think about, well, VPN. You either can get to the network through a VPN or you can't. Or network access protection or network access control mechanisms that say, you know, I plug into the wall or connect to the wireless, I can get on the network or I can't. So we have to think about access policies at those four levels and think about how coarse-grained and finely-grained we want to get at each of those levels. Then, of course, an enforcement strategy. Without enforcement strategies tied to our authorization and our business rules and our policies are worthless. So we have to make sure our applications are able to enforce the policies that we set, and ideally are set in a central way. And if we look at the claims-based access control with Windows Server 2012 for file access, we're beginning to see that Windows is beginning to adopt that model too. And we expect in the future that more applications will be able to adopt that model and give us the ability to get more fine-grained access controls. Finally, audit. Someone said to me that audit has nothing to do with identity, and I respectfully disagree, because like I said before, without auditing, all that other stuff we do is for naught. Because if we aren't able to tell how users use the system and provide us with the capability of having reporting and alerts that enforce the policies and identify the problems with our policies, then we have failed, I think, as identity management architects and designers. Okay. Auditing also provides us governance for auditing data and ensures that there are proper authorizations, historical accuracy, and compliance. Okay. That's self-evident, especially, and as painful as it is, but we all knew, I think, in the 1990s, in the early 21st century, that sooner or later we were going to have to grow up and that we were going to have to really account for our activities on the network, and that it was going to be our jobs as identity architects to provide the capabilities to allow us to provide the reporting that meet the requirements of political and regulatory entities. Auditing should also enable us to collate and centralize the audit data from disparate enterprise resources. And as you mentioned earlier, we're far from that vision. Okay? And like I said in the principles talk, you know, we're still early when it comes to cloud. You know, just like in the early 1990s, where client server was all the rage, and we're trying to figure out, this sounds really cool. How will I use client server? You know, the sneaker net was good, and I could share files among my different systems, but how's this client server thing? I remember seeing a PC Magazine, the cover that was talking about this screaming 386DX processor also had splash on top client servers taking over. Well, client server obviously took over, and then after that was the internet, but now we're talking about cloud. And just like maybe client server wasn't all intuitive and you're trying to figure it out back then, we're there with cloud right now. And so we have to think about how we use our identity management system to give us the auditing and then the reporting information that we need to answer the requirements of those that expect this from us. So reporting is just the instantiation of a human readable way of providing the information people need about the results of our identity and access control management process. Alerting, of course, is more real time. And this will be very challenging for us because as we look at our fabric management, security and identity mechanisms, and control capabilities, they have to all work together because we're dealing with complex systems. Now, I would love to go through our private cloud reference model here and show you the various problem domains within here, and maybe someday we'll integrate that when I finish my identity architecture work in the next next year, because we're dealing with, I mean, we're already dealing with complex disparate systems, and it'll become even more so as we adopt cloud computing. Okay? And of course, the collection of data, which I spoke about earlier. So how do you build an identity strategy? How have we been thinking about doing it? How has Microsoft Services been doing it? Well, we start with thinking about infrastructure optimization and identity. You may have heard about the I/O model. And so we'll talk a little bit about the I/O model and maybe correct some errors in communications that Microsoft has done regarding I/O and how you might be able to use it in your organizations when it comes to identity. And finally, how do you build an identity strategy? So first, we're going to have a good understanding of what the I/O model is about. Who knows about the infrastructure optimization model? Okay, so it moves, it goes from basic to standardized to rationalized to dynamic. What it does is it talks about the ability to automate and respond dynamically to system requirements, to organizational IT requirements. Okay? And the model helps organizations understand where they are in the model. One thing that we didn't do a good job with was communicating the fact that you may not need to be dynamic in everything, especially when we talk about identity management. We map the I/O model to identity. You might not need to be dynamic. You might want to be basic in some areas and standardized in another and maybe rationalized in another. It depends upon what your needs and requirements are, and let's see how we can move the bar towards dynamic, but not put you exclusively in dynamic. The model also helps you prioritize the actions and investments you'll need to make to boost for a higher level of performance, because the idea is the I/O model will make you more efficient and more effective. And it also helps you by standardizing, automating, important for cloud, and tightly controlling the IT infrastructure so that you can increase your efficiencies and potentially save costs. And this comes through automation and allowing IT personnel to move into that 60%, 16% I showed you earlier, where you should start envisioning ways of adding value to your company. So there's a bit of an eye chart here, but it goes through some of the descriptions of what, from identity process, what you can do to reach various levels of the I/O model. Actually, this is more a general discussion. But as you move from basic to standardized to rationalized to dynamic, things are becoming more more automated, more responsive without human intervention, and require less overhead to achieve your desired objectives. Now, if we look at this eye chart here, which I'm not going to go through in detail, this is a mapping, essentially, of the four pillars, administration, authentication, authorization, and audit, and the capabilities that we see as consistent with each of the levels of the I/O model. Now, what I want to make clear here is that we all aspire to move towards dynamic, but you might not necessarily prioritize all these capabilities as dynamic. For example, you may want automated deprovisioning of your ID stores, but you might just want to have one password for multiple logins because, you know, that's not so important to you. So when you think about when crafting your identity architectural framework, you want to be able to map these capabilities at each of the four pillars and see where you want to move the bar. So maybe you have no enterprise ID store here, for example, and it's important to you that you want to move the bar a bit so that you have an enterprise ID store as well as application-specific stores. And you can do that with any of these. The thing is that we want to look at a mass effect where you can move yourself further to the right. Be sure to download the presentation, and then you can study this on your own, because we found this to be extremely helpful in our own identity management systems, but also helping our customers come up with an effective identity framework. Now, when building an identity strategy, you should start with a self-assessment, an honest self-assessment, okay? what are your business priorities? And so you're going to have to talk to your various business groups, of course, to find out what the priorities are when it comes to identity. Then assess against the matrix that we saw on the previous slide. See where you are first and maybe circle those in red. And then see where you want to go and circle those in green, right? Or whatever your favorite colors are. And then you can start thinking about how to architect the change from current to desired status. Then build a plan, funny enough. We're going to build a plan. We're going to move forward. So we're going to prioritize our capabilities and define the roadmap. We're going to establish the architectural principles and guidelines, and then plan for remediation and new functionalities. And finally, because we've freed up so much time, because we've moved from basic and standardized towards rationalized and dynamic, we're going to have extra time on our hands. Maybe. We hope so. That's the goal. That's what we aspire to. That's what inspires us. So that we'll have more time to innovate and evaluate our roadmap and begin maturing the environment using the cloud principle of continuous improvement. These are service offerings that I'm not going to talk about today. And I thought I'd remove these slides. So, to summarize, our objectives were to gain an understanding of the key industry trends and how you might apply them to your designs. We did that. We learned about the four pillars of identity and how they'll be useful in creating your strategic direction. We accomplished that. And we learned about an approach we can use to create an identity framework. We were able to cover that a bit. Related content. We have a whole bunch of things. Now, probably most of these have already taken place since this is one of the last sessions today. And but you have tomorrow, too, right? Friday is the last day. So check out some of these. Of particular interest, I would say hybrid computing is the new net norm. But I believe that was delivered, was not delivered. Okay, so that is not available. This one is very interesting, the dynamic access control. Oh, so that's the name now. I was on that project very early, and we called it RBAC for roles-based access control. So now I know what it's finally called. Very good. This is also looks very interesting, managing and extending Active Directory Federation services, because that speaks to working with the partners. Resources. Go to this site here to find out more about the presentations. I found some people didn't know about this. So it's europe.msteched.com, where you can log in and get information about the sessions and rate the sessions, as well as MS Learning, TetNet, and MSDN. Submit your evals online at that same site. Use that path and sessions. Any questions, comments? Question. Comment. To a security guy. Okay. So the comment is that in contrast to my opinion that single sign-on is a potential Armageddon, an alternate opinion is that by not having single sign-on and maintaining dozens of different identities provides a situation where users may unintentionally expose multiple credentials and be with the end result of being less secure. So that's a good point, and I'll give you that. Any more questions? Question? Say that again. Single sign. Do we provide a single sign-on solution? We have service offerings, and we can probably cobble together a solution, would you say, that provides single sign-on using FIM, perhaps? Yeah, do you know FIM? So we could use FIM and some of the capabilities in FIM to provide a single sign-on solution. Have you investigated that yet? A little bit? Okay. Get with me afterwards. I'll give you my card, and I'll connect you with people who know about these things. Right. So the comment is that no single sign-on system is going to be a single system, right? We're going to have multiple systems tied together. So we have to have some kind of broker or arbitration or arbiter that is going to handle the multiple systems. Okay, thank you for attending. It was a real pleasure, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the session. Thank you very much. Thank you.